Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, Celeste Wesson, and Loretta Williams are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time, we're going shopping live from the Citadel outlet in Los Angeles, hard by the Golden State Freeway. All discounts, all the time, gang. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, that's American Public Media.
The time is 6:59. You are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. Coming up next, the Alaska Identity Project with your host, Adrian Lopez. For a complete list of our program schedule here on KTOO, check our website at ktoo.org.
And welcome back to another week of the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrian Lopez, broadcasting here on KTOO News Juneau, 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. In the first part of the Alaska Identity Project tonight, I'll be interviewing local author Lynn Schooler. And then from 7:30 to 8 p.m. in the second part of the show, I'll have Representative Beth Kurtula and Mike Levine from Oceana talking about Alaska's Coastal Zone Management Program, past, present, and future, and the work of the Sea Party to promote a ballot initiative to revive the program. Remember, if you're interested in talking with the guests or asking questions out there, you can write me at adriank@gmail.com. You can go on Facebook and find Alaska Identity Project, post a question there on my wall, or follow the show on Twitter at Alaska ID Project. I've also been keeping up my blog, another area if you're on the internet and you want to see some of the past guests and the links to the podcast or the recordings of past shows. You can go to adriankchile.blogspot.com. I also mentioned last week, or I put a plug in for the Southeast Economic Summit, which was something we organized at the Juneau Economic Development Council. A very, very successful event that happened this past Tuesday, and it will be rebroadcast. We had 360 North doing some web streaming for us, and if you're interested in watching that event again, you can go to jedc.org/summit and find the times that it will be rebroadcast this Saturday and next Tuesday. So, Lynn Schooler has quite a bio, so hang tight, Lynn. I'm going to try to piece a lot of stuff together. You are a wilderness guide specializing in working with professional wildlife photographers and natural history filmmakers for over 20 years. He's a two-time winner of Alaska Magazine's Grand Prize for Wildlife Photography and winner of the National Wildlife Grand Prize. He's lived in Alaska for over 40 years and is the author of The Blue Bear, The Last Shot, and Walking Home. In 2002, the Blue Bear was awarded the French Literary Prize, Prix Littéraire 30 Millions d'Amis, among many other awards, such as being selected by the editors at Amazon.com as their number one choice in nature writing in 2002. In 2010, Lynn published a second memoir, Walking Home, A Traveler in the Alaskan Wilderness, A Journey into the Human Heart. By November of that year, Walking Home was awarded the Banff Mountain Film Festival, Banff Mountain Film and Book Festival's prize for Best Mountain Literature of 2010. Lynn lives on a small, quiet cove 25 miles north of Juneau, and you have built your own home, or you started building in 2005 using as much recycled and or reclaimed material as possible. That was on Facebook.
And I'm still building.
You are still building.
I don't know if it ever ends.
How does that go? Have you learned along the way?
You have to just go at each individual project and not even think about the end of it, about okay. finishing, especially when you're trying to use as much recycled material as you can, because the difference between salvaging a 2x4 and going down to Home Depot and picking one up is about four times the work.
Wow.
You know, so the man hours in it are just insane.
Is it hard, though, in Juneau, or easier? Because you find that people have a lot of stuff they want to get rid of.
Well, it's
right?
It's easier in the sense that people that know I'm doing it, I wind up with some wonderful materials. Some of it has Juneau history involved in it, or Alaskan history.
Really?
I've got marble that was salvaged from when Wally Hickel remodeled the Capitol building back
Whoa.
In the 70s. I've got... Part of my flooring is made from the birch room dividers that were used at the elementary school here until it was remodeled 2 years ago.
The one in Douglas over there?
No, in the valley.
Oh, in the valley,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they were going to the dump, and one of the workers there told me I could have them, so I hauled them off and turned them into flooring. And,
wow.
And all of my cabinets and doors and stuff are made out of wood that I sawed out of the trees we dropped putting the road into the place.
Wow.
So if a tree came off of the place, I'm trying to put it back into it, which
very
is totally
neat.
Nuts. I'm not advocating this, that anybody do that.
Well, maybe you could create a guide later on for how to do this. No. All right.
No.
Well, good luck with that project, Lynn. And that's actually where I wanted to start, because a lot of times I ask people about their past or their background, but wanted to ask you about your current projects, what you're working on now, and where you spend your time.
That's a big part of it, is the home building mm-hmm. project. And trying to I've actually got 4 books out. I had another book come out the same year as Walking Home under the pen name of Lynn D'Urso, a novel. The entire publishing industry is undergoing such a sea change that I'm trying to figure out now what it means to be a writer. It's obvious that ink and paper are going to change, you know. Maybe being a writer also means going back to photography and video and combining all of these different medias into a narrative, you know, into storytelling.
Mm.
You know, it's kind of exciting and kind of scary.
Yeah.
And I like being a writer. I like making books, but that doesn't work anymore as a template for making a living.
Mm.
You know, so trying to figure out how to still be able to call myself a writer and put out things that people are going to read and use is a challenge.
Yeah, that is. And when did this start? I mean, when did you start thinking, wow, this is really changing and
scare
you a little bit?
I'm one of those crotchety old codgers that sort of denied that the digital age was ever going to happen. You know, books have a hard cover and pages you can turn and you can write on and mark your spot and everything. And wasn't that interested in the internet. You know, the State Historical Library here was my home as a writer,
yeah.
You know, a wonderful resource.
Yeah.
What happened was they overthrew the government of Egypt using Twitter.
The Twitter revolution.
This is going to be big someday. I need to pay attention.
So just recently, I mean, that
very
was this
recently.
Year.
I just got off a dial-up modem a few months ago.
Wow.
Yeah, so the whole Facebook thing and everything is a new
That's
experience
new too.
For me. I've been on the, instead of being on the information super freeway, I've been on the information dirt road for the last 15 years, you know. And what I've learned from it so far is that I think people are reading just as much. I hear a lot of writers complaining that people aren't reading anymore, and that's simply not true. It's just that the way we read has changed immensely in a decade.
Mm.
You know, what people expect of the written word is vastly different now than it was 10 years ago, which was different than it was 50 years ago, which was different than it was 200 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's kind of my project right now, is wake up and figure out where the world went to while I was having my little fantasy about, you know, my Olivetti typewriter.
So you're trying to understand this. Have you talked to other authors to kind of get a grasp on that?
You try to, but
or writers.
The bottom line, I think, is that nobody knows.
Mm.
Nobody knows where it's going.
Mm.
You hear of phenomenal success stories of people self-publishing digitally and all, but, you know, there's 200,000 self-published books in digital format, and most of them are really not very good.
Mm.
And 100 copies or 100 downloads is the average.
Mm.
And but at the same time, we've also got a capacity now to target a very specific reader, whereas before you had to think about books that might sell 200,000 copies.
Yeah,
you know, which would be a very popular book. Now, with the change in the cost of things and distribution and the internet and the digital format, maybe a very successful book is 15,000 downloads.
Hmm.
Yeah. But you can look for those 15,000 people much easier than you could when everything had to be done through radio interviews, book reviews in newspapers. You know, the online world of reading is vastly different, largely because it has done away with what I think of as the gatekeepers to literature. for the last 50 or 75 years, really it's been a couple hundred people who've decided what we could read, what would be available. There are only so many chief editors and so many really big shot agents. And so everything people wrote had to go through this incredible filtering system. And a very small group of people was deciding what was going to be available. And now, you know, anybody can publish anything.
That's true.
You just got to figure out how you're going to stand out in there, in the herd. How do you get through the noise to the people you want to talk to?
And there's still people, you find people that say, well, I like to read a book in my hands, you know, not have my Kindle.
Well,
or
well, it's digital sales are still only 10% of book sales. You know, digital book sales have exploded exponentially over the last 3 or 4 years. But the vast majority of books per se now are still paper. But the publishing houses, the publishing industry is just teetering, you know, financially. That's going to change. It's changing incredibly fast already. And so it's kind of fascinating and kind of scary to figure out what am I going to do next?
What's next?
What kind of media is it going to be?
Huh.
You know, how do you knit things together into something that has some kind of redeeming value and people still want to pay you $2 to read, you know, or see or listen to, you know?
That is good. Well, I mean, would you give advice with all these transformations to other authors or writers that are young people that are thinking about taking this field on?
Yeah.
Not get into it? Work hard. How do you?
You know, I don't think that part of being a writer's changed.
Yeah, it's true.
I have a friend who's a very successful screenwriter, and he says he has one rule. And he says, he told me once, is the biggest reason he's done well, and it's keep your butt in the chair.
Okay.
Which means put your time in.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's possible now to get published easily, but if your work is bad, it's not going anywhere. So you still have to do the work.
Good at what you do. Now, it was actually a question from Mike Zachariah, who I met the other day doing some of the web streaming, the sound guy for 360 North, and he actually, one of the questions was, how has the digital world changed your photography or affected that part of your work?
Well, the first thing it did was pretty much shoot my business as a guide down.
Okay.
My guiding business, working with professional wildlife photographers and film crews, has evaporated over the last few years because digital photography has made it much easier for a lot more people to be good photographers because you can get into it relatively cheaply. It doesn't cost you a dollar every time you push the shutter and, you know, use up a slide and had to take it to the developers and wait for it to come back. You can look at it and see if it's good. But what's happened is the amount of really good photography in the world has just exploded to where when I first started guiding, you know, serious people who were making their living as wildlife photographers, a really good picture of a breaching whale might sell to a large glossy magazine for $300 or $400. Now I just sold 9 photos to a major publication, and my paycheck is going to be $150.
Jeez.
Yeah.
And you're known for this, right? You're known as a photographer.
Yeah,
well known for that.
Well, the thing is things like Flickr and Facebook and all that have made wonderful photography free to the vast majority of people. So publishers simply can't afford to pay, you know, to have, you know, several thousand dollars invested in every issue, because people won't pay the cost downstream for that when they can go on the internet and see just as good images for free, you know, and even download them and use them themselves.
True.
So it's another one of those challenges, you know.
So you're taking less pictures, or you still take as many as you used to?
I probably take more, but I pulled back from trying to be a professional. All I carry now is a point and shoot. The vast majority of my photos on Facebook there are just from a little Olympus point and shoot that's not much bigger than a credit card, which is great. You know, it's given me the capacity to always have a camera.
You know?
And you see great photos coming off of iPhones. You know? So that's a huge change
better.
Over having a backpack on that weighs 60 pounds because you got two or three different formats and seven lenses and, you know, 40 rolls of film and a 25-pound tripod. And, you know, a lot of my work as a guide for photographers and film crews was as a pack mule. You know, when we were shooting 16-millimeter film, it wasn't unusual for my pack to weigh 70 pounds. You know, so now it's 4 ounces,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody can afford a high-def video camera that's every bit as good as a Super 16 film. Different, but very good.
Very good, yeah. Actually, Mike, along that line, he asked if there was any other technical gadgets that enhance your enjoyment of the wild places and creatures out there.
Technical gadgets that enhance the enjoyment. No, actually, I think a lot of too much of an involvement with technical gadgets is probably going to pull you away from that the real experience of being in wild places. Mm. You know? It's very easy to get infatuated with the technology, which is one reason I've decided to just stick with a very basic point-and-shoot, one thing, you know, not get carried away with too many of the bells and whistles of available to photographers and filmmakers now.
Yeah, keep it simple.
Because it still boils down to storytelling.
Hmm.
You know, and if the photo or the little film clip has an intriguing story in it, then it's my experience that it really doesn't matter if it's perfectly sharp and clear and, you don't have to be a technical virtuoso to still tell a good story with a photo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. So what kind of story are we talking? What do you like? A person's face, an animal?
I'm not a very good people photographer,
okay.
But I have friends and acquaintances who are really gifted at it. And I'm sure everybody's seen portraits that just took their breath away. I mean, the classic is the blue-eyed Afghani woman who was on the cover of National Geographic about 15 or 20 years ago. Yeah. When I mentioned that to you, you shook your head. You nodded your head, yes. You know, that photo came out when you were probably 12 or 14 years old, and you know about it. You know, that's what kind of a story can be in a face.
Mm.
You know? That's a gift I really wish I had. Because it is a gift. Yeah.
To really capture that.
Yeah.
See it and be observant. Yeah, are there other photographers local or in Alaska that you admire?
Oh,
and
gosh.
I live in Mark Kelly's Vale. I shouldn't say that
yeah,
where
Mark,
I live.
Mark is Mark has done a fantastic job of making his work Juno. You know, when you see a really great photo, you know, in a magazine or a calendar or whatever, Mark Kelly's work has a classic Mark Kelly signature to it. You know? John Hyde is world class. Kim Hecox over in Gustavus is one of the better photographers I know. And Joel Bennett, you know, who's been a photographer and filmmaker for, gosh, I don't know, 40 years, he is probably the best living photo storyteller I know now.
Wow. What was his last name? Joel?
Yeah. Joel Bennett.
Bennett, okay.
Mm. Yeah.
Look these people up. Get them on a show. So between photography and writing and being a guide, is there something that you've enjoyed more or the most out of the three? Or maybe you have another
Well,
passion?
All of that has given me an unparalleled opportunity to live a lifestyle and have experiences that the vast majority of people in the world can only dream about. You know, for 30 years, I've been so lucky to get to do things, incredible wilderness experiences with really gifted, talented, smart, creative, you know, fun people.
Yeah.
You know, I've gotten to do trips all over the world, but particularly here in Southeast Alaska with people in situations that I can't imagine having come about any other way. than being lucky enough to specialize in this field, in this place, in Southeast Alaska.
Is it your favorite spot in Alaska? Have you traveled to all the regions and like anyone
in particular? Yeah, it is. You know, Alaska's, when you start trying to tell somebody about Alaska, it's like talking about Africa or South America.
True.
It's everything, you know. I'm actually, just as I've drawn back from very complicated, very gear-oriented stuff to just using a point-and-shoot or a single lens or something, I'm becoming more and more and more infatuated with my locale, particularly, specifically, the watershed I live in now, out the road, you know, because from the sea there, you know, from the Salt Chuck up the river to the glaciers and into the mountains, is there's more to learn about that one watershed than I think any human being can gather in a lifetime. And so I've spent the last couple of years becoming as intimate with that little piece of land, piece of the Southeast as any place possible.
Your space.
And the more I learn about it, the more I realized I don't really know much.
You want to learn more about the biology or the
everything,
the plants?
You know, I went to hear Bob Armstrong, Robert Armstrong, give a talk the other night, who is also another of our incredible photographer, naturalist, writer residents in Juneau. And I came away from there feeling like I don't know 10% of what this man knows. You know, he's a bit older than I am, but there's hardly an element in natural history that he doesn't have a profound knowledge about. And we have half a dozen people like that in Juneau that I'm familiar with. Mary Wilson, you know, who works out at the visitor center during the summer, is just remarkable. Kathy Hocker, the things they know. Richard Karstensen, you know, these people make me feel like a third grader, you know, talking to somebody with a PhD, you know. It's like Greg Streveler, who lives out in Gustavus, is so deeply involved in the environment of Southeast Alaska for so long that I remember when I first met him maybe 20 years ago, 25 years ago, was out in Glacier Bay. Mm-hmm. And he picked up a stone off of the beach and started talking about that stone, what it was, how it was made, how it had probably come to be there, you know, just 15 minutes later, he's still talking about this rock, and I'm utterly absorbed in what he's got to say about this rock. That's how much you can know about one simple thing.
Amazing, huh?
So, yeah.
So if I were to look at your bedside stand, what are you reading about?
Oh, listen. Well,
these
actually, right now, what I'm doing is,
in
the interest of trying to become a better writer, I'm reading all of the short stories in about 40 back issues in the New Yorker magazine.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. There's just, my bed is just littered with New Yorkers all paged off in different places. You know? I'm trying to figure out how to write much shorter, tighter, more intriguing bits instead of long, involved narratives. My storytelling tends to be very complex, like in The Blue Bear and in Walking Home, where I do weave in a lot of cultural and environmental and natural history and personal history into a single narrative arc. And that's my natural way of looking at the world. But I think in my observations of the coming digital age, I think it becomes imperative to a writer to become more poet than long-winded babbler like I'm being right now on your show.
No, you're not. So you mean we have a shorter attention span?
No, I think we're hungrier for more knowledge. It functionally may be a shorter attention span because people are becoming more used to being able to cover a lot of ground very quickly. Mm. It's the way the Google page works when you put in a search subject. You don't read those things, you scan them. Mm. But you can, some part of your brain allows you to pick out the information that pulls you in. And I think the writer's business now is to put more into less. because that's the way people are learning to learn.
Hmm.
Yeah. And this is just a hypothesis.
No,
I have not proven this by any means, you know. But it's it goes back to reading all the short stories in the New Yorker. Is I'm a long-winded writer, and I think I have much to learn from people who are very gifted at telling short stories.
So have you learned any ideas or picked anything up in these short stories? Anything that helps you, guides you as a writer for future?
It would be hard to be specific about without kind of winging it too much.
Yeah,
I could probably give you a fancy answer, but I don't know if it'd be right.
Not know? To the point.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. That's another thing I've gotten smarter about as I get older, is to just say, I don't know.
That's good.
Learn more that way.
That's good. Some cultures can't do that. Down in South America, it was tough. They're very long-winded in Spanish. You find that you can read a whole paragraph and be like, wait, the point was just that word.
Yeah.
English is good than being more succinct sometimes.
But I don't know, but I suspect, and you'd certainly be the person to answer this, aren't the younger people in Spanish cultures, South American cultures, also changing the way they read and relate and learn and what they expect of the written word?
Yeah. I mean, the world's pretty much uniform in that sense, I would say.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody's
connected. It's a fascinating time to be alive.
It is. Yeah. It is. It's exciting. And you've had an interesting life. If you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Lynn Schooler. He is a local author, photographer, guide, wilderness guide here on KTO News. This is the Alaska Identity Project with Adrian Lopez. So no more books in your future. It's going to be shorter things.
I wouldn't say no more. No. Yeah. I guess I'm working out, figuring out what that's going to be. Okay. My sister just recently gave me a Kindle Fire so I could start experiencing digital books.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I will probably put out something small soon on my own just to see how people respond to it.
Yeah.
But I think the long-winded story that's bubbling to the top here is about living and intimately with a place, about my home range there, up and down Peterson Creek. And also I've become sort of enamored with the idea of spending 1 year living as if it is my last. Not in a melodramatic way, but as in saying, what do you really want out of your year? You know, what is it you really want to do or accomplish or experience or feel or see?
You know? Wow, so a bucket list.
No, there's something kind of facile about that phrase. I'm sorry, but not you know, I don't want to go jump out of a helicopter. I don't want to, you know,
skydiving.
Well, really, you know, Adrian, if you had 1 year to live, you know, and you weren't sick, you know, and you have your resources and you can do anything you want for 1 year, it's almost like you get a magic wish.
Mm.
If you can have one wish for anything, what's it going to be?
Mm.
And don't tell me you'd waste your wish wishing for $1 million
to
go to Italy for breakfast.
I mean,
it's a hard question.
Yeah.
You know? So
a year.
Yeah.
Well, how much have you thought about it? I mean,
a lot, but I haven't answered it.
Okay. Well, you know? Any
Maybe there's not an answer. I don't know. You know, it's to discipline myself enough to get up every morning and say, what do I want today?
Okay.
And if you're down to day 221, what becomes important? When you're down to 105, what's important? When you're down to 61 days, what's the most important thing to you today?
Yeah.
You know?
I love to eat. I love enjoying good food.
That's a good one.
And wine.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, this is the concept of voluntary simplicity. Our good friend, our mutual friend, Eric Peterson, of course, asked me to ask you about that concept.
Well, your answer there, you know, good food is one of the things I've come to, you know, in my trying to plan this year.
Okay.
Is good food, you know, good company, good friends. I would really, if I only had 5 days left on the planet, I would much rather have a really good dinner with some of my dear friends who are great cooks, with fresh salmon and fresh king crab and venison and the great things we've got right here, than go to some five-star restaurant in London. You know, that would be my preference. Mm. That's not a hard call. Yeah. So simple things locally, you know, particularly if you're lucky enough to live someplace like Juneau and have a community like this with so many remarkable people in it, in the middle of a huge, visually appealing environment like this that is more intact than almost any other environment on the planet. You know, we've still got all our pieces, our original pieces, and there's not many places can say that anymore.
That's true. The only intact rainforest, right?
Yeah. It's very limited. Most places on the planet, when somebody looks out their window, they don't see a lot of what was there to start with. Mm. Yeah. And we're lucky to live in Southeast because there's nothing missing. Nothing's extinct. We haven't been overrun with all kinds of invasive and alien species of plants and animals. As a result, we're phenomenally rich, you know, in things like I can go out my front door and throw out a Dungeness pot and, you know, get half a dozen crabs overnight. Not a lot of places can say that.
No. And my lungs are suffering after living in Santiago. I'm like breathing fresh air here.
Yeah, please. Rain is good.
I know. Yeah. It's the simple things in life.
The simple things. Yeah.
I can't believe we're already at a half hour. Where did that go? Wow. Well, I didn't get to all the questions I had, but Lynn, maybe I can have you back on again. I was going to ask if this year kind of thing has anything to do with 2012, if there's something there that
no,
it doesn't. Okay, because
no,
my last guest did.
I think our doom is long and protracted.
Okay, we're suffering.
But I'd be glad to come back sometime, maybe.
Great. Yeah. Well, I appreciate taking the time to be on the show, and I encourage, if you're out there, including me, myself, I will be reading your books, The Blue Bear and Walking Home, among other ones.
I appreciate that. Every writer appreciates that.
Yes. Thanks for your contributions as well.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. If you're out there, stay tuned for the next half hour. I'll be talking to Beth Curtula, Representative Beth Curtula, and Mike Levine on coastal zone management. Stay tuned.
All day, I just sit and wonder if love isn't one big blunder. But when you hold me tight, tingling all through, I feel somehow I was doing all right. But I'm doing better than ever now. Tingling all through, somehow I was doing all right, but I'm doing better than ever now. Doing better than ever now. Sky, so vast is the sky, with faraway clouds just wandering by. Where do they go? Oh, I don't know, don't know. Wind that speaks to the leaves, telling stories that no one believes. Stories of love belong to you and me. Oh, Gingy, if I only had words, I would say all the beautiful things that I see when you're with me, oh my Gingy. Oh Gingy, like the song of the wind in the trees, that's how my heart is singing, Gingy, happy Gingy, when you're with me. You more each day, yes I do, yes I do. I'd let you go away if you take me with you. Don't you know, Gingy, I'd be running and searching for you like a river that can't find the sea. That would be me without you, my Gingy. Every kiss, every hug seems to act just like a drug. You're getting to be a habit with me. Let me stay in your arms, I'm addicted to your charms. You're getting to be a habit with me. I used to think your love was something that I could take or leave alone. But now I just can't do without my supply. I need you for my own. No, I can't break away. I must have you every day, as regularly as coffee or tea. You've got me in your clutches and I can't break free. You're getting to be a habit with me. Can't break it. You're getting to be a habit with me. Hug seems to act just like a drug. You're getting to be a habit with me. Let me stay in your arms. I'm addicted to your charms. You're getting to be a habit with me. I used to think your love was something that I could take or leave alone. But now I just can't do without my supply. I need you for my own. No, I can't break away. I must have you every day, as regularly as coffee or tea. You've got me in your clutches and I can't break free. You're getting to be a habit with me. Can't break it. You're getting to be a habit with me. Can't break it. You're getting to be a habit with me.
Welcome back to the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrian Lopez here on KTOO News Juneau, 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. The music you were just listening to is Stephanie Patton. She is a Southeast artist out of Ketchikan. Stephanie Patton, so it's good to promote the local artists. We are joined here by Mike Levine in the studio. Mike is Pacific Senior Counsel for Oceana, the largest international organization dedicated solely to protecting the world's oceans. He has a BS with distinction in civil and environmental engineering from Cornell University, a Juris Doctor with high honors from Duke School of Law, and a Master in Environmental Management from the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke. Beth Kurtula, Representative Beth Kurtula, is also joining us on the phone. She is the state representative from downtown Juneau Douglas and House Minority Leader, which is the highest rank for a minority member in the House. She's been elected 7 times to the Alaska House of Representatives from District 3 in Juneau. Beth comes from a long-time family in Alaska, a long history here. She earned her BA from Stanford University, her JD from the University of Santa Clara. She worked as an attorney in both private and public practice before running for office and was the Coastal Zone Management Program's attorney for 5 years. She's married to Jim Powell, active in the outdoors, and plays with her dog, Cody. Beth, are you there on the phone?
Yeah, I am. Thanks for, who knew? Why is AT&T doing this to me? I can get Facebook and everything else on my phone, but I couldn't get a call, so
yeah.
I'm glad I'm on. Thanks,
yeah, I'm glad you're there. I put on Facebook, Beth, call the studio.
Yeah, I know. I was just going, I wonder when they haven't called me yet. Yeah, thanks.
So I guess we have a little bit less time, so let's start with some past. Coastal Zone Management, could you just explain to the public out there what we're talking about?
Is that me or mine?
Yeah, let's start with you, Beth.
Okay. The bottom line is this is the only program that gives Alaskans a direct say in what happens to their coastline and coastal development. And it's also the only program that, like, puts the applicant, the person that wants to do a project, build a dock, build a mine, build anything, in the room with state and federal permitters. So it's very powerful. It really is a program that makes things work. It makes the fisheries work alongside development. It makes a dock work alongside a river. It makes things real. So if we don't have it, it means people are going to have to go around and get their permits coordinated by themselves, which is no easy task. And really, the big picture is it loses our say. We no longer have a say in these things. So it's a very powerful program. It's something that really, we should have never lost it. And so having done that last session, even after two special sessions, when Mayor Bruce Botello called me and said, hey, do you want to be part of this movement? I said, yes. So we're now certified. We were supposed to have our petition booklets Friday. That's been pushed back. Hopefully we have them next week, and we'll be out on the streets getting signatures to hopefully get this through the legislature, and if not that, on the ballot in 2012, so people can bring our coastal management program back home.
Okay, good. That's a good kind of summary of it. Mike, how do you get involved in this, and what's your kind of history with the Coastal Zone Management Program?
Sure. The best place to start is with what Oceana does. Mm-hmm. So we work to protect and maintain ocean ecosystems. Yeah. We work for vibrant communities and healthy oceans that support sustainable fisheries. And the Coastal Zone Management Program is an important tool toward helping ensure that communities and local residents, those affected by decisions that affect oceans and coasts, have a say in that process. So Oceana is working with Beth and Mayor Botello and others to help gather signatures to ensure that this initiative gets on the ballot in 2012. And also just to add about half a sentence to the place that Beth started us would be to say that this is not a new program. Yeah. Alaska has had a coastal zone management program since 1979, and it was let lapse by the legislature last year. And so we have a long history of allowing community involvement in these decisions and creating durable solutions to the kinds of issues that Beth talked about.
Mm. So, Beth, it's been around since 1979. You were a lawyer, or the program's attorney, for 5 years. Is that how you first got your start?
Yeah.
With the program?
Yes, and we have a joke in coastal management, and that is anybody who's ever worked with this program, you never get away from it, because it's really such a wonderful, wonderful program. It really brings local people with state people with federal agencies, and it's the only place where you really all sit down together to hammer out solutions. So, you know, once you get involved with it, it really grips you, because it is the one program that really has worked on a state and national level to bring people together to make good decisions and as Mike just said, durable. I really love that word, durable solutions for our coast. We tried really hard to get it during session, and we just melted down in that, 90-day session, which is too fast for Alaska anyway, but it was just a total meltdown at the very end, and we lost it by very little. Again, lost it in special session, and so it's just sort of a heartbreaker. We are now Alaska with almost three times the coastline of the rest of the United States put together. We are the only coastal state without a coastal zone program. It's just wrong.
Wow. So other states, they've also had the same program for the same amount of time. Give us some examples.
Many of them have had them as long as we have, but recently, because the Great Lakes are also eligible, recently Illinois just came in making us the only state with coastline not to be. I mean, yeah, it's really embarrassing, but it's worse than embarrassing. Truly, my examples are real. If you want to build a dock, I mean, you could have to go to Fish and Game, DEC, U.S., Fish and Wildlife Service, the Corps of Engineers. I mean, you could literally, as one person, have to go around to every agency yourself to do that. Jeez. And it makes no sense.
The program, we hear a lot about trying to push the federal government out of Alaska. And this is one instance in which the federal government in the early 70s decided that it would be good to give states And local municipalities some say in the decisions that are being made. So this program allows states and communities to have input, to be at the table over decisions that otherwise the federal government just makes without our input. And it's paid for. We would get funds for this program from the federal government, so we wouldn't have to pay for it ourselves. So it's win-win-win all the way around.
So it benefits all Alaskans.
It's absolutely right. What Mike just said is absolutely right. It is the most powerful tool we have. It is the only tool that absolutely allows us to have our say. Otherwise, you know, we might be able to send a letter, you know, saying to EPA, hey, we think this is important, but we don't have the strong tool that coastal zone management gives us.
Yeah. So if it's such a great program for us that benefits our state, then what are the challenges here? What's the pushback?
You know, I think it's just, frankly, a misunderstanding. I think it's that somehow people have misunderstood this program to be another layer of bureaucracy, when in reality, it's a program that cuts through the bureaucracy. Mm. It's also a program that makes projects work. I think maybe sometimes people misunderstand. There are one or two cases, you know, where maybe this program said, no, not yet, not now, we can't have a project. And for instance, when I was their lawyer for 5 years, we had three cases go to court. But out of the thousands of permits that were permitted, that were allowed, that were, you know, modified so they would work, people seem to remember the one or two cases. And so it's really, what I will say is the people of Alaska, the communities, the North Slope Borough, I think Mayor Itta said it right, like, what's not to like about this program? Mm-hmm. So I think the people of Alaska get it. We've had an overwhelming response to the initiative process. People are just ready. They're on the ground, ready to go. And I will say it was really hard to deal with hearing that we were not going to get our petition booklets this Friday as we had hoped to hit the big weekend. But you know what? When we get those booklets, people around the state are ready to do this because they know on a real local, personal level what this program does for them.
Mm. Adrian, this isn't a program that's really about yes or no. It's a program about improving decisions. We're trying to find ways that we get all the affected people to have input into decisions, and when that happens, you'll get decisions that will last, and it should, and I think did, reduce controversy rather than cause controversy.
It's true. That's it on the balance. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's back up for a second. The initiative process. Let's explain kind of like how this started. What's going on right now? What's the name of the Sea Party? How'd that name come about? And what are you guys hoping from the public out there?
Sea Party is a completely grassroots program. We just, a group of us got together, and I give total credit to Mayor Bruce Vitello, who, I mean, I had thought about it after session ended, but to tell the truth, I was just so disheartened. Thought about it. I thought, oh, I just don't have the energy to do this. And when Bruce called and said, hey, we should do an initiative and we should talk to people about this, I said, yeah, I'll help. So what's happened is for the last, now it's about 65 days, a group of citizens just got together. We said, we need to save this program. We sat down and had a great group of people help write the initiative, people who have had a long history with the program, and we tried to put the best parts of the previous programs into place, into a bill, and we filed it with the Lieutenant Governor, and we just got certified about 5 days ago. When that happened, it triggers the ability of the Division of Elections to give us pamphlets so that we can go around and get signatures. We were told we'd have them by Friday, and really people are calling saying, where do we sign? How do we do this? Now it's going to be a little delay, but in the meantime, what we've done is around the state in all 40 districts, we have people waiting to get those booklets. So that's what it takes. It takes 30 out of the 40 districts, and we need 26,000 signatures.
Wow.
And, you know, maybe I'm an eternal optimist. I think we're going to do it. We're trying to get them before session starts, before January 17th. And if that happens, it will put tremendous, it'll be a tremendous statement by the people of Alaska so that the legislature can go back and try to rectify that. If that doesn't happen, then we'll be on a 2012 ballot. We'll either be on the primary or general ballot for people to vote on it. So that's what we're trying to do. I think we're going to make it. I think they've thrown up a bunch of roadblocks and delays. And, you know, I don't think it's going to work. I think we are going to get those signatures because people are so ready and on the ground waiting to do this.
This is it's a great example of the citizens of Alaska taking the initiative to do what the legislature would not. That's what the initiative process is designed for. Mm-hmm. It's designed to give the people of the state the ability to have mm-hmm. their voice when the elected officials don't or can't do what the people want. And here, the Beth and Mayor Botello, the mayor of Kodiak, and folks from mm-hmm. the Kenai Peninsula Borough and others. I think there are 280 co-sponsors
wow.
of this initiative all around the state. And there's a network of citizens, just people like mm-hmm. you and me and Beth and others out there waiting to go out, gather those signatures. And when those signatures are gathered, the initiative, as it's written, will go on the ballot to be voted on by the entire state. And if the state passes that initiative, it will become law, and the legislature will not be able to undo that law for at least 2 years. So we as the people of Alaska, will have had our say about the importance of the Coastal Zone Management Program, and we will implement it ourselves because mm. the legislature will not.
Mm. So the strategy then, you hit the ground running as soon as these petitions are done. You guys have kind of your plan of how you're going to get these signatures. And then after that, after you get them, being optimistic, you will then be promoting, you're pushing people to vote for this. Like,
I think.
Give me a strategy.
I think that's right. And Beth, you can correct me if I'm wrong. Part of the strategy is to encourage the legislature to do this itself mm-hmm. During session. And if that okay. doesn't happen, then the people will have to have their say in the 2012 election.
Right. We sort of have a win-win. Either the legislature does it themselves, mm-hmm. which saves a lot of time and energy and money, or it goes directly back to the people, and the same people that signed those petitions will get the chance to vote on it. So it's either going to be one or the other. And by law, the legislature has to pass something that's substantially similar. That's the term of art, substantially similar. So by law, if the legislature does that, then it's done. If it doesn't do it, then we're back to the vote.
And it's important, something I probably should have emphasized, you know, if you're out and about and somebody approaches you with a signature book to sign, you're not voting for the initiative. All your signature does is say that you think that the people of the state of Alaska should get to vote about whether this program is a good idea or not, and that it shouldn't rise or fall just based on what the legislature does or does not do.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's really important. And I think most Alaskans understand that, but just again, if you're out and someone approaches you with a signature booklet, please, please sign it. What it does is it just allows it to be on the ballot. You know, you'll have much more time. If you want to get more detail, call me, call our program, you know, sit and talk. But let people have a choice and let the legislature have a choice again. I mean, it's so important.
Mm. And if you want to see the initiative, you want to see the fact sheets, you want to see the initiative law so you know how it works, you can go to the website, which is www.alaskacoastalmanagement.org. If you're in Juneau and you want to stop by the office, it's 217 2nd Street, and the phone number is 957-4540. If you're out and about and have questions and you know me, or if you don't, you're also welcome to call me. I'm happy to talk with you.
Mike, okay.
Me too.
Are you guys going to have a Facebook page? You probably create
one. Yeah, or get on my Facebook page or get on the program's Sea Party, Alaska Coastal Management Facebook page. we're trying to do as many things as we can to give people an opportunity to get the information.
I think if you Google Alaska Sea Party, it's the first or second thing that shows up.
It probably doesn't have a lot of it.
And I mean, we did. We thought about the Tea Party, but we really liked the Sea Party idea. So.
It's cute. Yeah, I like it.
Thank you.
So if once I hear that I can sign, should I be looking for people on the street or should I go to your office, Mike?
Yeah.
Either way.
Go ahead. You can go to the office on 2nd Street once the booklets are out. There will be people out and about. It would be shocking to me, Adrian, if you did not get approached by 5 or 6 different people with signature booklets.
Can I sign many times?
And
no.
Juno especially. All you have to do is walk to KT. You'll see
someone. And I expect at some point there will be folks out specifically gathering signatures, at A&P and Fred Meyer and Safeway. It's important to know we have to get signatures from both districts, both downtown, Valley and out the road, so we'll be gathering signatures from all over town.
And all over the state. People are listening from other parts of the state,
that's correct.
Too, right?
And from Barrow on down to, right down to the end of our, southeast.
It's one of the great, this is one of the great things that the creators of our state did in allowing this initiative process to happen. It means the folks, as Beth said, up all the way from Barrow to wherever the southernmost point in our state is.
I was trying to think too. Southern, I'm going like, what's our southernmost? But anyway, the tip is southeast.
And everyone will get to have their say.
Great, great. Well, last week I was...
Direct democracy.
Yes, right. Well, Niels Andreasen last week was on my show talking about this hyper-citizenship and everybody being very involved. So that sounds like what we need right now, some hyper-citizens. Well, great. Thank you, guys. I'll post it on my site here, KTOO, as well as Facebook. And best of luck. And thanks for calling in today, Beth and Mike, for being in the studio.
My incredible pleasure. Sorry about my phone, and great to be here, Adrian.
Oh, well.
Thank you, Adrian. Thanks, Beth.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Go sign your petition.
Yeah.
Bye.
And the public for tuning in tonight to the Alaska Identity Project. This is Adrian Lopez. We'll see you in a couple weeks. I think I'll be off the air for a couple weeks, but stay tuned for the next show. Thanks again.
The moment that you passed by, I felt a thrill, and when you caught my eye, my heart stood still.
All the other rich nations give paid antenatal leave. Namely, women who are working outside the home get paid leave for several weeks and as much as 12 weeks. Studies show it makes those first 9 months healthier. We need to focus on early life and paid time off to be pregnant or to parent as the first major medicine we need. Some people call